Well, it's 8:06. You're listening to KPCW, and of course that means we've got Erica Martin, ABC Forecast Center, on the line. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Leslie. We are having a great day in the forecast. I'm looking at the latest model run, the North American model run for Thursday, so I'm kind of looking ahead, but I'm going to work my way starting today. So today's temperature in the upper 70s with mostly sunny skies. Now, just to the south of Park City, we're going to see some dynamic activities. I don't expect any dry lightning for Park City, but just be aware of any fire concerns because we're still in that red flag warning until later tonight, 9 p.m. But a great day in the forecast, lots of sunshine, upper 70s, overnight lows in the upper 50s. For Tuesday, we're going to see 75 as the high, overnight lows 54 degrees, and then we're going to go right back up into the upper 70s again. So we're kind of going from upper 70s to mid 70s to upper 70s, a very nice, interesting stretch with mostly sunny skies through Wednesday. By Thursday, looks like there's a weak disturbance that moves through later in the day. So I'm going to go with increasing cloud coverage on Thursday and a chance of an isolated thunderstorm, a high of 82 degrees. Then we hit 84 by Friday, and by this upcoming weekend, we're still going to keep it in the 80s with mostly sunny skies and possibly a few extra clouds. Otherwise, a great rest. So the only unsettled day that I see coming up with the newer runs as well would be Thursday, and that's only if this little disturbance is strong enough to really make anything happen dynamically. Otherwise, conditions are going to be mostly sunny and definitely a warm stretch in the forecast. So just enjoy it in the meantime.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
808. That is Erica Martin, ABC Forecast Center. Well, Wasatch County Council voted Wednesday evening to approve issuing $2 million to the preservation of a 100-acre dairy farm in the valley. KPCW's David Boyle has more.
In November 2018, Wasatch County residents voted to issue a $10 million bond to be used for preservation of open space in the county. The bond can be used to buy development rights off of properties, meaning housing and commercial buildings can't be placed on the land while still allowing farmers and ranchers to use the land for agriculture in perpetuity. The Albert Kohler Legacy Farm is a 103-acre dairy farm located on the north end of Midway between River Road and the Provo River. In 2019, the Kohler family signed an agreement with Utah Open Lands to sell the development rights on their property for $7 million. The project applied for two of the $10 million available through the Wasatch County Council. Before approving the project, the council heard a presentation from Utah Open Lands and members of the Wasatch Open Lands Board, which advises the county council on dispensing of the funds. The board uses an application process to evaluate those asking for funds. The Kohler Farm checked all 19 factors of consideration, including community, educational, and agricultural benefits. County Manager Mike Davis did share his concerns of issuing the bond funds during such an uncertain time in the economy.
I'm concerned about the tax situation the county's in. The voters voted for the bond, I understand that, but the voters are also going to see a significant tax increase this year without this bond, and with this bond, it's going to be more. That's a concern to me. I think the fact that we're having this hearing before the tax notices go out as a disservice to the taxpayers, because how can the taxpayers know what they're really going to be up against from a tax standpoint until they have the tax notices? Now, I understand that it wasn't done this way to do that. I get that, but I am concerned about that.
Wasatch Open Lands Board Chairwoman Heidi Franco pointed out that interest rates for bonds are low right now.
Saving land is a good or bad economic cycle endeavor. Whether it's good, whether it's bad, we have to save what we can when we can. We're encouraging you to act in a timely way so that all of these balls that Wendy's juggling with all of the different funding sources can still stay in the air and come together on this deal.
Utah Open Lands has now secured $6.25 million of the required $7 million for the easement, with several million coming from federal and state funds, $2 million from the county, and $1 million coming from Midway City's open space bond. At the meeting, 8 people shared public comment all in favor of the project, including Midway City Council members Steve Doherty and J.C. Simonson, as well as Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson. Wasatch County Council member Steve Farrell says preserving agricultural heritage in the valley has been his goal ever since he joined the council.
It took a battle. We had trouble for even getting it through our own planning commission. And then the council, we were very cautious of spending the taxpayer money. Each time we seen another one of these farms developed, it became more evident that we had to do something. I appreciate help in getting everything in line so that we could present it to the taxpayers. An open shelter-in-place bond that they supported over 70%. This is a necessity if we're going to keep any of the rural character of this valley. This is only one of many projects we ought to be doing. I hope this is the first of many.
The council voted unanimously to approve the use of $2 million to preserve the Kohler Legacy Farm. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
Well, good morning. It is 8:12. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. And this morning, our first guest is Midway City Mayor Celeste Johnson. She's here to talk about the dispute with Rocky Mountain Power about the timing and cost of a power project that will go, gosh, about a mile into the city. On the phone to talk to us this morning is Mayor Celeste Johnson. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, let's see here. So Midway and Rocky Mountain Power have kind of gone back and forth regarding this transmission line project, disagreeing about the cost to bury the line and how urgent the project is. And now a court case has issued a stay on the project. Can you talk a little bit about that and let people know what that means?
Yeah.
Well, it looks like we've lost Celeste Johnson. Hang on one second. We'll get her back on the line. Well, while we're getting Celeste Johnson back on the line, many parts of the local economy have been sluggish. Summit County's Development Director, Pat Putt, says it's not slow in his office. Rick Bruff has more.
Putt said in recent days they've seen about 30 applications walk in the door representing a myriad of small to medium projects. For instance, the Smith's Grocery at Kimball Junction has applied for a low-impact permit to add an expansion area at the back of the store.
About 3,000 square foot expansion onto the back. Apparently, they are so busy, given the period of time that we see ourselves in, they're having a hard time keeping store supplies, groceries, and food in the store. They're running out of space.
Over at Silver Creek Village, Mountain West Housing Trust is planning a condo plat with 64 units in a two-lot subdivision. The village's master developer, Matt Lowe, is presenting a sketch plan for Elk Springs with 125 single-family units. The Mountain Trails Foundation is proposing a new home for itself on the former Belcher family property along Highway 40, once home to the menagerie that included a zebra and buffalo. The Belcher home is now slated to host the Children's Justice Center. Putt said Mountain Trails wants to locate in the nearby barn. Bill White Farms along Highway 224 is proposing a new driveway configuration and parking, and there's a proposal in Lower Silver Creek to change a parcel from rural residential to community commercial. Putt said details on that will follow. He said his counterpart in Wasatch County, Doug Smith, is also reporting activity is the busiest he's ever seen there or near it. Putt said he will leave the economic experts to explain what's going on, but he had a few suggestions.
People are fleeing the more highly populated areas with the hopes and aspirations that they're going to have a little more space and mountain communities like Summit County and Park City. Could also be that money at reasonable rates is available to put into projects. I think it's a whole host of those. But if there was a sense out in the community that COVID has killed the planning and zoning world, quite the opposite.
Summit County Development Director Pat Putt. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Yes, it is 8:17. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. We have Celeste Johnson, mayor of Midway City, back on the line to talk to us, at least first off, about the dispute between Midway City and Rocky Mountain Power about a burial of a power transmission line project. And thank you for joining us. And let's give this another shot, Celeste.
All right. No problem.
Okay. So with the court issue stay, does that mean there's enough time to issue a bond question to Midway citizens on this November's ballot?
Yes, there's certainly enough time to issue a bond now and to get that on the ballot this election cycle. The stay was very important to us because what it really meant to us is that the information that was reviewed by the Utility Facilities Commission, and we completely disagreed with their opinion, but the fact that we are able to take all of the information that we presented at that meeting and take it to now an appellate court, the appellate court has reviewed all of our information, our documentation, our case, essentially, And they basically, by granting the stay, have said, you know what, there's enough evidence here that this case does need to be heard by an appellate court. So now we are in front of a judicial body rather than a governor-appointed body. We believe that the outcome will be far better. As you mentioned earlier, the biggest dispute for us, Rocky Mountain Power is saying, fine, you can bury the line, you just have to pay for it. And we're saying, okay, fine, give us a price. And to come back with something that's between $5 million and $20 million is clearly not acceptable to a municipality. We're not in a position to say, yeah, we'll pay whatever it costs. We believe it is much closer to $5 million and that that's a number our citizens can handle.
So how does this assessment come about? Is it done through the Utilities Commission or is it handled by Rocky Mountain Power?
Yes, by Rocky Mountain Power. So they have their, of course, vendors that they use, and we fully understand that. They sent out basically a request for a bid to three separate entities. I believe actually four. One of them stepped away from the project, and three estimates came in. They gave them the criteria and asked them to supply the information. And what we found, or I should say the expert we hired to review all of this found, was that what they were putting in their estimates were things that they have never done before, the type of line, very expensive, very Rolls Royce, and all we need is a Chevy, you know? And then there were also several errors that made it so that the distance varied from one bid to another. And those were the things that we said to the Utility Facilities Committee, you know, come on, make them go back and get an accurate bid with real stuff. And I'm oversimplifying, but you get the point. And the Utility Facilities Committee came back and basically said, you know, it's not our job to regulate who they choose to hire and how much they choose to charge.
So what happens now?
So now we go to this appellate court. The appellate court will thoroughly review the information. And I should mention that Rocky Mountain Power filed what's called an emergency request to rescind the stay. So they, after we were granted the stay, they filed, and the appellate court judge that ruled on our case said, no, we're denying your request. The stay is granted. So Rocky Mountain Power has gone back now. This is their last Hail Mary pass here that they, instead of being looked at by just one judge, it has to be looked at by three judges of the appellate court. We believe nothing changed. We believe the stay will come back this week that it has been granted, and Rocky Mountain Power will have been refused again.
Okay, and what makes you think the bids that came in are so high? I mean, you mentioned some errors. You mentioned things like, distances.
I call it Rolls-Royce wiring.
Yeah, and the wiring.
Couple of things. First of all, we've got some independent estimates from companies that do this. They just don't happen to be Rocky Mountain vendors. So we've got a good sense of what a fair price is. Secondly, we hired an expert, and this is a company that just completed an underground transmission line project in Jackson Hole. They call it the Lower Valley Project. So very familiar with it. It's a very, very similar situation. He reviewed the request for bid. He reviewed each of the bids, and he came back and said, you know, wait a second, you don't need all of these things that you've put into this bid. I've never ever seen them. And even in the when we were in front of the Utility Facilities Committee and the questions were asked, have you done these things before? Rocky Mountain Power basically said, well, no, but we think if we're going to go to this expense, we might as well do it. And my attorney is saying, well, you know, if it's something that's not needed and you want it, that's fine, but you pay for that. We only pay for what needed. And, you know, that's where the disagreement really lies.
So these court proceedings, how much of a delay will it put on Rocky Mountain's project to actually start, you know, getting to work on putting those lines in?
We anticipate anywhere from 1 to 2 years. And frankly, we hope that we can work something out in the meantime. It has never been our desire to be litigious about this. We have tried multiple times to sit down and work out an agreement. So we hope that perhaps this could do that. I'll tell you straight up that even our experts said, yeah, this project does need to happen, and it probably should have happened maybe 5-7 years ago. So we know there's an urgency here, but because there's an urgency on Rocky Mountain Power's part, in our opinion, doesn't necessitate giving up our right and our voice to solve their dilemma.
And I guess with utilities, it's common practice then for the utility to actually seek the bid on something like that? that and,
sure,
and use
yes.
that. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. A city can't go mm-hmm. out and independently get their own bid and say, this is what we found and this is who we want to use or that type of thing.
Correct. We knew that. We were just trying to get a base. We were trying to get a sense of, okay, if we were going out and doing this project, you know, what kind of numbers would come back? And we'll probably do a little more of that now that we've got this extra time. We can't be a dripping pen for Rocky Mountain Power. We need a firm price, a price that they will hold to, and a price that we can go back to our citizens and say, okay, in the survey, y'all said you'd be willing to pay this amount. You know, here it is, and it won't be more than this. And that's what we're looking for.
Yeah, can't be a $5 to $12 million window. Okay, let's move on and talk about the Homestead Resort Master Plan. City Council heard a request for an amendment to that plan. What are the proposed changes and what did the council decide?
So the council has decided to take this to a work meeting. There's enough of complications, I guess I would say, or maybe it's not quite as straightforward as you might think. We just felt like we needed an opportunity to dive into it a little bit deeper. The master plan that was granted in 2008 is what is being requested to be amended, and the Homestead Group, and that's not their official investor name, so I just what we call them. I can't remember what they're called, but the investment group that has come in and purchased the Homestead, they were hoping to be able to make these changes without having to go through a lot of the preliminary and be in front of the Planning Commission, et cetera, et cetera. We've looked at the plan. We believe there are elements of it that they can proceed with without any problem, but then there are certain other elements that we do need to take a deeper dive. And we're actually very excited about this project. We feel like it's a good project for Midway. It's a good project for the Homestead. I think everybody agrees that the Homestead has gotten a little tired and it needs a shot of, good old currency to bring it back up. And that's what this group will do.
Okay. And is there a timeline for when construction starts and that type of thing?
I think they'll start immediately on some of the things that we've granted approval for right now, kind of remodeling things that don't dramatically change anything. At the last meeting, I understand that they're hoping to work on the golf course all through the winter. So come spring, those new buildings will be ready and the golf course will be ready. Obviously, that golf course is a jewel and it's needed a lot of work as well. So as I understand it, those are their two criteria. Then there are some new buildings that were not on the 2008 master plan. And those are the things that we'll have to take a closer look at.
Okay, and that's what you're kind of waiting to see a little more detail on. And
yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and we have scheduled a meeting for the 21st, so next week at, I believe, 6 o'clock, but it will be on our website.
Okay, and will this be a decision at this point or just a discussion?
We can't make decisions in work meetings, so it's our opportunity to take kind of a deep dive and get a better understanding, but then it will have to come in front of the council during a regular city council meeting to be motioned on and have a decision.
Sure. And as we've reported, the Kohler Dairy Farm in Midway has received some significant funding for preservation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that quickly?
Yes, that's so exciting. So the Kohler Dairy is one of the last dairies still functioning in this valley. I believe at one time there were over 30. And this is a family that's been very committed to farming and to the dairy industry for generations. Their big push several years ago was artisan cheese, and that has become extremely successful for them. This dairy encompasses over 100 acres. Now, there's a small section where the dairy is and their homes and so forth that are not part of the conservation easement, but all the surrounding property is, and that's about 102 acres. And this has been a project that Utah Open Lands has been working on for some time. And when the county passed their open space bond and Midway passed theirs, then Utah Open Lands realized, okay, now's the time we could really make this happen. And so they have gone after federal funds and received it. They've received funds from the McAllister, the Ray McAllister Fund, private sources. That property, the conservation easement, was appraised at $9.9 million. The Kohlers are willing to accept $7 million, and if they sold to a developer, of course, it would be worth even quite a bit more than the $9 million. So they're really leaving a lot of money on the table in order to keep this a working dairy But as we know, these smaller operations cannot compete with the big boys without something like this, grant money, or in this case, the money that will come from this conservation easement will give them the capital they need to continue to function and to function in a modern setting. They have a state-of-the-art milking barn. I call it the cow spa. It's unbelievable. So there's only a handful in the state. In fact, maybe even just two or three. But the bottom line is, it's a profitable venture. It's a dairy. It's exactly what this valley is trying to preserve. And Midway put money in. The counties put money in. We've all come together to do just that.
Okay. Well, thank you. We're going to have to leave it there this morning. Thanks for joining us, Celeste Johnson, Midway Mayor.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye now. It is 8:30. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. And next on the line, I have the Executive Director for Park City Christian Center, Rob Harder, on the line. Are you there, Rob?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah,
so thanks for joining us this morning.
So, thanks for having me on the show.
The community is still turning to the Christian Center for food and help paying bills and getting just sort of sustaining through this time period. Can you give us a quick update on the numbers, Rob?
Absolutely, yeah. It continues. So we've gotten, we've distributed so far just about $600,000, and over 90% of that is for rent. We do help with people's, you know, utility bills and power bills and insurance bills, but the large majority, again, over 90%, has been rent assistance. And so we've gotten most of the people that we've, you know, gone through the process with anyway, we're already almost done with the second round, and then we've already started the third round now of rent assistance. And we just have a sense that, you know, we did a survey, by the way, we're going to get send out the results. I'm happy to send it to KPCW and to Park City Foundation and others who want it. We asked our recipients how many people are working. And initial results are that many people are starting to work now, but they're not nearly full-time hours. They're more like 20 hours, sometimes at most, maybe a little bit more, but very few people are working full-time hours, at least at this point.
Sure. And how is it managing that kind of a just a variety of people who are in need and where they are and things, and how do you go about actually distributing those funds?
You know, yes, I've shared before, it's been a little bit of a challenging process, particularly early on when we had, you know, no one could come to the office, you know, everything was shut down because of COVID-19, of course. And so pretty much our process is we ask them to send us, say they need rent assistance. So we just ask them to send us whatever, you know, apartment agreement, their rent agreement, some kind of paper trail, because we get audited every year. They will ask, you know, where this money gets distributed to. They'll want to have, you know, audit/paper trail. So we do ask for that. So our recipients had to take pictures of that with their phone, because not everyone has a computer. In fact, most people do not. But everyone had a phone, so they just took pictures on their phone. They sent it to us. So just getting, making sure it was a clear picture, getting that process, and then, like you said, processing through what is the real need, making sure there wasn't duplicates. You know, sometimes I think people were just, you know, wanted to respond and needed help, and sometimes we had a husband and wife both asking for support, and we really felt like with the money that we had available, we could only do one per household. Sometimes we had roommates that were asking for support, so we tried to process that as much as possible by having, we had staff people assigned to each one of the various clients that requested help, and we had, you know, interaction, whether it be on the phone, through email, so we had interaction with them, we asked follow-up questions, and we also tried to help them figure out where else they could find help. So, for example, Jewish Family Services is also helping with rent. St. Mary's Church has been helping with rent. So we felt like one of our jobs is not only to help them, you know, with rent, and our goal was at least $475 was on average what we were giving to families, was to help them navigate through the other resources available, because many people, you know, their rent was like $1,200 on average. And so we weren't paying for the entire amount of rent. We were paying for a portion of it, and so we're helping them navigate again where else they could get help.
And have you heard of any families, you know, being pushed out of their homes or their living situation?
Good question. So far, no. What we have heard is there's been some threats, sadly, of eviction, but no one has, that I'm aware of, has been evicted yet. As you probably know, I think it's been on your show a couple of times, and with Leslie as well. Technically, the federal kind of a rule to that there's no eviction during COVID-19 runs out at the end of July. And so some have been extended through August with a new ruling, as I understand it. So there hopefully will not be any evictions, you know, until August. But at the same time, we have heard, as we've tried to interact with landlords and we've interacted with, you know, apartment managers, there is a concern still that people could be evicted by the end of August. So that's still a concern. That's partly why we're ready to do the third round and staying in contact with landlords and trying to work with them. We've been working with the city and the county as well to say, what else can we do to provide that safety net just to make sure no one gets evicted? But to your question, no one at this point, as far as I know, have been evicted, which is good news.
Sure. And how have your fundraising efforts been, you know, since the shutdown and changes in just how we come together and socialize and raise funds and support our nonprofits? How has that been for you?
You know, I think we have to say we've been unbelievably just blown away by the generosity of our community. We have received a tremendous support, I feel like, from this community, you know, to help raise the funds that we have for this rent assistance. As I mentioned, the basic needs, our food pantry. So our basic needs assistance just alone, we've raised nearly $700,000 for that. So that's all from the community. So that sense, I think that the response of this community to the immediate needs of making sure people stay in their homes and no one goes homeless and no one has their water turned off or their power turned off, no one goes hungry, that we've seen tremendous response. And so I know Park City Community Foundation, their community response fund has had a huge, I think they've had over $1 million raised already, maybe more, in Jewish Family Services. I know they've gotten some great support. People's Health Clinic has gotten great support. So I would say from my vantage point, at least those nonprofits that are doing that immediate emergency kind of response to our COVID-19 crisis, we've received great support from our community. So we're super thankful.
Yeah. And what about the food pantries? Are you finding that any of the pressure on that has lessened at all since things have started to open up?
Yeah, you know, actually, it has, and just by our numbers. So we had, during the height of COVID-19, so for 2 months straight, essentially we were serving 1,000 people a week between our Heber store and our Park City Food Pantry store. And now we're down to, I would say, more normal levels, just right around 25 to 2,600 a month. So it was up to 4,000 a month. So we're, you know, what is that, 55% less. And that's kind of anywhere from 25 to 3,000 a month is normal for us. So it's definitely gone down. I would say it's calmed down, if you will. So our hope is, number one, that everyone who needed food got it. And I also know that we had some international students that were here. They were kind of stuck. They couldn't get back home. And that was a big chunk of people that now have, luckily, they've been able to go back home. So they're not coming to our food pantry course anymore. And this is kind of a lull anyway in the summer with you know, seasonal workers. Normally, we have a big influx of new seasonal workers that come. But because of COVID-19, of course, that didn't happen. And so our numbers have gone down a little bit because of that too, that normally we'd see in a normal year a bit of a spike because the summer seasonal workers would come and most of them all come to our food pantry at a given time. So yeah, so it's still open. We're open Monday through Friday. You know, you can come into the store. We're actually back at to a self-serve model, much like a grocery store. You can come and pick out what you want, you know, within limitations of what we have. So if you're listening, yeah, for certainly come out. We've had plenty of food. That's the other thing, that the grocery stores, you know, there was a lot of fluctuation there for a while. Sometimes we had a lot of food, other times we didn't have much, but now we're at a really good level. We feel like we have lots of fresh food for those who need it. So we encourage certainly people that need food, stop on by.
Great. And you also continue to offer counseling. Is that correct? How would someone get help if they need it?
Absolutely. That one, I continue to encourage people to contact our counseling center. You can just call the Christian Center, our main number, and you can go to our website. It's probably the easiest. Just go look at Christian Center Park City, and you can look at our counseling page. Heather is our administration manager for that. She can help you get set up. We have counseling scholarships available. So if you can't afford a full amount, we can cover that through our scholarship fund. So we definitely encourage that, as you ask. I mean, this has been one of those where I feel like, you know, you mentioned the food. We feel like we really were able to respond quickly, and then the need for food seems to have dropped a bit to more normal levels. However, having said that, the mental health counseling, we have seen an uptick, and that has not gone down. It actually continues to go up in terms of the number of calls we get, the number of needs we have for mental health issues. I think you've had people on your show over the last couple of weeks. It's across the country now because of COVID-19 and other things that are going on. Mental health issues are just skyrocketing in terms of anxiety, depression, suicide ideation. All those things have really, really increased. And so we want to make sure people have the resources they need. And the good news is we have a lot of counselors to choose from. And so, yeah, we encourage you to check it out and we'll get you set up with an appointment as soon as you need.
Okay. And so you're pretty much able to respond within, you know, if it's a crisis or somebody is in really dire need, you can respond fairly quickly then?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
So if it's a crisis situation, yeah, please let Heather and or whoever you end up contacting and let us know that, and we will respond accordingly.
Okay.
Sure.
And what about the thrift? How are the thrift stores coming along? Are you taking goods? Are you encouraging that? Is there a system in place? How are you handling all that with the?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked, because it's actually been really nice, because I think, you know, having any sense of normalcy is kind of nice, you know, and with our culture has been kind of turned upside down. So we have seen a lot of people shopping now, and they're coming to our thrift store. They're coming to the Heber store, and we've seen a lot of good sales now. We're almost up to normal levels now with our sales. And, you know, one thing I was really just proud of this community, we've had no pushback for the most part. People are wearing masks when they come in. Our staff are wearing masks, of course, but like we encourage and we ask basically to wear masks when you come in to shop, and everyone's doing it. And so there's not been pushback. There's not been a lot of, angry customers or whatever. People are doing it. And so that's been good. So it keeps everyone feeling safe as they go shopping. And then, yes, you can definitely donate your things. We have a great system in place now where as people drop off, we've had a ton of people donate, of course. It's been pent up for many months of people, during COVID, we had, people just storing up their things in the garage. And so the good thing is we've gotten through a lot of that initial rush of wonderful donations. So we encourage you to keep doing that. So we're open, again, normal hours, if you will, Monday through Friday. Actually, sorry, the receiving is open on Saturdays as well, Monday through Saturday for receiving, and our stores as well, Monday through Saturday. So come on by, get some great deals. And if you're ready to donate some things, get them out of your garage, we are accepting those donations.
Okay. And then just finally, Rob, can you kind of give our listeners a sense of the overall health and vitality of the communities you're serving? How are people's physical health in general? We have heard so much on the news about how this illness has affected people of color and the Hispanic community in particular. And I just wonder if you can kind of give a general overview of that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's no doubt that there was a huge uptick in the Latino community, specifically with the COVID-19. And so the good news is, I think, because we have great resources like the People's Health Clinic, our hospitals responded very well, and we did a great collective effort, I think, as a community. I think of Lynn Ware Peak and the city and the county all working together to make sure we're communicating, particularly again to the Latinx community, to say, here's different times where you can get tested, making sure that people that needed PPE had that available at no cost. So I think there's been a lot of efforts in our community to make sure, number one, if you need to get tested, you can get tested. If you are sick, then you get the help that you need. I've just really seen the community rally around that. So I think they've definitely been impacted in a pretty significant way, but I feel like our response has been very strong. And so I think that has really encouraged people and really helped during this time. So I think it continues to, as you know, the numbers are still going up. It feels like the percentage is spreading out amongst our entire population. So it's not just in the Latinx community anymore, but I do think that's still an issue. So I think it's still a little too early to see how all this is going to shake out, but I think the resources are there to respond to people that have had, come down with the COVID-19 and or those who are just worried about, protecting themselves. I think we've gotten all the equipment out to people that need it. And then the last thing I'd say, for me, I think the issue that's really continues to be a little bit of a concern, just from what I hear from other nonprofits as well as our own counselors, is again the mental health issues. I feel like those are not maybe spoken about as much. And then when something really happens quickly, it is very often, if they're, particularly if there's a suicide attempt or something along those lines, it's so sudden and it really surprises people. So I think that's the thing that I really probably am most concerned about still, is that issue that just needs to continue to be talked about and make sure people know where the resources are and where to get help, because that is a significant of a problem right now, I feel like, as getting the COVID-19. I think those both hand in hand are things that we need to continue to focus on.
Yeah. Okay. And if people, do you have a need for volunteers? Do you need help, continued help financially? Is there a place people can go to get involved?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. Yeah, we definitely are looking for volunteers, and we've got a good system now where we feel like it's a very safe experience. Again, you wear your mask, so please bring your own mask. But we can go to our website and go to the volunteer tab. We do need volunteers for our stores right now, because we've had, like I said, the sales have really upticked, and we've had a lot of great donations. So whether it be the Heber store or a Park City store, So go to our website and go to Christian Center Park City and click on volunteer. Now, that would be great. Our food pantry, always in need of great volunteers. That will be wonderful. And then certainly, you know, as the rent assistance need continues, in other words, I still feel like without people getting 40 hours in full work where they've gotten a full paycheck, I think the need for paying for rent and help with rent will continue. So we certainly could use some more help to help us make sure that we can help those who need bills assistance and rent assistance. So certainly you can go to our website and just go to our donate now, and you can pick the basic needs assistance if you're really interested in helping people with rent. And we're always looking for help with that. So thank you in advance.
Okay. Thank you. That's Rob Harder with the Park City Christian Center. Appreciate you coming on this morning.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Yes, well, on Thursday evening, Park City's council voted to approve the proposed Huntsman Estate subdivision in Deer Valley. It's a 15-lot parcel, is located about 10 acres, is located off Royal Street near the Stein Erickson residences. And Sean Higgins with KPCW has this story.
Even though City Council did approve the Huntsman Estate subdivision on Thursday, there was some strong dissent from some councilors and members of the community over maximum house sizes in Deer Valley. Currently, there are no laws regulating house size in Deer Valley. You can build as big as you want as long as it all fits on your property. Anthony Fallis is a longtime homeowner in the Belterre subdivision and expressed his concern over the potential of a house or houses being built that did not, quote, fit the neighborhood.
A strong feeling about it is that there should be some kind of limitation on the total square footage on the 14 additional lots, as well as some kind of maximum size for a house that can be put on the properties. And I think it's reasonable that this should be in keeping with the neighborhood. And what is the neighborhood? The neighborhood is the Belterre subdivision, the Belmont subdivision, the Evergreen subdivision, the American Flag subdivision. That's the neighborhood.
Fallis adds it is his hope the Huntsman subdivision would avoid a similar situation to the Red Cloud subdivision, which has one house significantly larger than others in the area and sticks out from the surrounding landscape. The city's neighborhood compatibility study found the average house size in Deer Valley's neighborhoods to be just shy of 8,500 square feet. It is worth noting the one large Red Cloud property does bump the average higher, with Red Cloud's average house size at nearly 11,500 square feet. Councilwoman Becca Gerbert was the lone no vote and cited the need to consider the future of the town and the environmental impacts of ever-increasing house sizes in the area.
I do understand that we need to come back and have another discussion of this, of lot sizes and house sizes. But I kind of think it's an interesting argument to say that it's not fair to limit lot sizes on these things. I think that one of the things that we've really learned over the past, our generation, and is that we just don't have the same resources available, both water and land, and with our carbon footprint and with climate change and everything that's going on, that as we move forward, we need to be doing better. And we need to be doing better for the future. And having these huge developments that come in with these huge houses doesn't speak well to where we're going as a community and what we're willing to do for future generations.
Councilwoman Gerbert's comments opened discussion about the possibility of changing the law to regulate house sizes in the future, similar to how other mountain communities have in other parts of the country. Colorado's Crested Butte, for example, limits the maximum square footage of their new houses. If City Council were to approve any change to the law, it would not affect the Huntsman Estates because the subdivision was applied for before any change was made. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Good morning. It's 8:50, and this is the local news hour. Abby McNulty is the executive director of the Park City Education Foundation, and she is on to give an update on what they're working on and how they continue to accommodate this current ever-changing environment. Good morning, Abby.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you. So let's before we kind of get into the things that are happening with your organization, I'd love to know how you're involved in the back-to-school effort. Such a spotlight is on back-to-school nationally, regionally, locally. As we get closer to August 1st, the school district will be bringing a formal plan to the state. The mask order that was put in place last week by the governor, and those things are going to change the environment quite a bit. What is, as the director of the Ed Foundation, what are your thoughts about all of this, and how are you involved in helping craft just what it will look like?
Sure. Well, it's certainly the decision of Park City School District what back to school will look like. I know they've been working with teams of teachers and administrators and community members over the summer to come up with a variety of different scenarios depending on what happens this fall and winter. But school will start in person on August 20th. And you will also, if families are not comfortable being in person, there's also an online option. And the school district is registering families now at their website, pcschools.us. So I encourage you, if you haven't registered your child or children, to go ahead and do that so that the school district can plan for your kids' attendance. And I think, you know, in general, this is a really tricky time. As you mentioned, the governor has a new mask order. We have our own mask order in Summit County. And we're just seeing a lot of conversation about what it takes and what it will look like to be back in school. And frankly, I think, you know, everyone who works in the school space knows that this is complicated. There's no easy answers, and it's really about everyone's individual comfort level and with what they would like to do with their kids. And as a parent, I'm grateful that Park City School District will have an option to be in person and online this coming fall.
Yeah, such uncertainty, and there's all this sort of conflicting science out there about how children, you know, pass the illness on, whether they do or don't, and so there really is a lot of uncertainty. And it does sound great that you're going to be able to have the option as a parent, but oh my gosh, how will that be covered in terms of the costs of doing that, along with teachers being able to manage both online and in-person learning? That's
right. I think, and I think that's a big discussion nationally. Is, you know, schools are being asked to do a lot more than they have in the past with, you know, less funding than they had previously, and so that kind of is, you know, a call, I think, for our community to think about how our schools are funded, and also for the Education Foundation. Our role is to infuse philanthropic investments in the school to help all students reach their academic and lifelong potential. And for us in this time, it's really, it's very important for us to remain nimble and flexible and creative so that we can continue to provide additional resources to our schools. Because frankly, they're going to need it now more than ever. There's a lot of unknowns as we go into this fall and winter. And I think we just need to remain as nimble and as flexible as possible to support what teachers and students will need.
Yeah. And just finally on this topic, what are you hearing from parents? What are they saying to you? Are most parents supportive of it, of getting their kids back to school, even with cases rising, crazy? I mean, it's,
Right. I mean, it's hard, right? When schools closed on March 13th, I think we recognized for the first time, very intimately how much schools play a role in our daily lives as parents, our ability to work uninterrupted. My daughter just came up to me with a note asking me questions as I'm on this call. It's just schools have this are part of our social fabric, not just, providing our kids with access to, important academics, but it's also childcare. It's also socialization and engagement and creative exploration and mental health services and physical well-being services for a lot of kids in our community. There's 25% of the kids in our community live in poverty, and they rely on school for basic needs. And so I think for every family, as they're looking to the fall, every family is going to need something different, and they'll make their own decision what's based on what's right for them.
Yeah. Well, and nutrition is something that we can't really put aside, just how critical that is to, not just our 25%, but just millions of children around the country. So what about your programs? What do you have happening that you maybe would like to share, things that you're funding this year? What's going on with the foundation?
So last month, we actually distributed about $250,000 of investments into the schools. So that, in addition to the emergency express grant that we did all last offering, which was totaled about $45,000, giving teachers the ability to make investments to support students in their online learning and distance learning. So those emergency grants supported everything from pens and pencils to families that didn't have them at home to online technical tools to improve the delivery of instruction online. So we issued those in the spring, and we plan to continue that program this incoming year because we know that, our best laid plans, we know there will be some unanticipated events and experiences that will require some nimble support into the classroom. We also just awarded $250,000 into classroom grants to support our traditional programs, our STEM initiative, all the programs that we typically fund. And we're also raising money to support unanticipated needs. I mean, really, we could never have imagined where we are today, 12 months ago. And so we just know there's going to be unanticipated needs. And so we're also looking to raise support for that as well. And we will distribute it as the needs arise. And for us, typically we have an event in the fall, our Red Apple Gala, which raises a good portion of our resources every year to support our programs that we invest in. And we will not be hosting our Red Apple Gala this coming year as we have had in the past, which is a 300-person event at the Montage. So we will do a much more scaled-down version of that activity, but look to raise the same resources as we have had in the past, knowing that our schools need us now more than ever. We'll also ask parents to give in the back-to-school time frame to the Education Foundation. We always ask for $180 per student per year, and that $1 for each day your child is learning. I think making a contribution in support of your kids' academic this year, I can't say it enough. It's probably needed more now than ever. Our schools do have unanticipated costs of the COVID pandemic, such as PPE, additional cleaning, all these different safety precaution measures, and that has to come from their budget. And so the more we can raise as a community to philanthropically invest in our schools, the more our schools will be able to be nimble and pivot in support of kids' academic and social emotional learning.
Yeah, sure. Anything else you want to say quickly? We're about out of time.
Just appreciate everyone. I hope, that everyone is so generous to the education here. Really appreciate that. And thank you for listening. And also just enjoy the summer. School will be upon us quickly. And enjoy the last weeks of summer. And don't forget to register your child for school, which starts on August 20th.
Sure. All right. Thank you very much. That's Abby McNulty with the Park City Education Foundation.
Thank you.
Bye now. Before we take you back to NPR, just give you an update on weather. It's 55 degrees, 9 o'clock here in Park City, and we are looking at sunshine through the week, actually, with a slight chance of showers on Thursday and a high of 84. And in Heber City, it's going to be a bit warmer, but same kind of forecast, high of 95 in Heber today, and sunshine through the week. Thanks for listening to the KPCW Local News Hour.